David Hawkins is senior editor at Roll Call and writes the Hawkins Here blog and is writing today about a fake building to look at to give us a signal as to where the budget process for federal agencies is going in Congress. David, thank you as always for joining me. What's the fake building that we should be paying attention to in this budget as it moves forward, and why should we pay attention to it when it's not even real? Thanks for coming on.
It's the fake White House, not the which insert joke here. It is the Secret Service wants to spend $8 million to construct a what I call the Potemkin White House, like the Potemkin Village out at the Secret Service training facility in Greenbelt, where they have plenty of other fake facilities. They have a fake retail mall. They have a fake urban streetscape. They have a fake Marine One, a fake Air Force One. For some strange reason, they say they've never been able to build a fake White House. It's unclear exactly how much detail they want to put in this fake White House for $8 million, whether it will be even all four sides of it or the interior or what it will be. But they say at a minimum, it will mimic the fencing and the lawns and the basic shape of the White House. And this is the best way to train so that the agents and the guards that live and work at the White House can do a better job protecting the First Family. Now, so the point of my piece is that all might make sense if you live in the non-political world, you know, that training, law enforcement does a lot of training. They train in simulations. That's the way you do good training. But at a time when the Republicans are out to pick apart almost anything the president stands for or proposes, this one is a pretty juicy target because it has, you know, it sounds comical, has the word fake in it. It's, you know, if they're going to say if the Secret Service can't do the good job protecting the real president, they're not going to do any job better job protecting the fake one. So my point is, at $8 million, this is pretty slim pickings, and the Republicans have all year to go after it, and they will be it'll be difficult for them to resist that temptation.
You write in this piece, since an agency as beleaguered as the Secret Service is pursuing the money with a straight face before a chorus of already raised eyebrows on the Hill, it's a rebuttable presumption. There's some merit to the idea. And you detail some of the issues that the Secret Service has undergone, and we have details on all of those, of course, at federalnewsradio.com. How do we use this, though, as you point out in this piece, as some kind of a harbinger of what we can expect to see as the budget proceeds? Is it as simple as if they'll go for this, things will go one way, or if they go against this, things will go a different way, or is there more to it than that?
Well, it's not quite that simple, but I guess I'm saying it's a good sort of canary in the coal mine, that if the Republicans buy what Director Clancy says, which is that this is what the Secret Service needs to do its job, to do the kind of training it needs to do, and they leave it alone, that will suggest that the Republicans are going to sort of be sober and serious about this appropriation cycle. But don't expect that to happen, because, as I say, it's a very juicy target. Both parties like to do this, especially when one party is running Congress and the other party is running the White House. The party that with the purse strings likes to poke at the president's party in all kinds of petty sounding ways. My favorite, which I wrote about in this piece, was in one of my early days covering an appropriations bill. The Democrats, actually led by Jay Inslee, who's now the governor of Washington State, when he was a congressman, actually got the House to vote on having the Congress not pay the utility bills at Dick Cheney's vice presidential mansion. Worth a grand total of $130,000.
Oh dear!
But they said, we don't like Dick Cheney, and he's an evil guy, and let's let him freeze in the dark.
Huh? Well, so
didn't work.
Yeah, I imagine not, and I foresee, fortunately, not as much of that kind of thing this year, because we now see a budget resolution proposal from Congressman Chris Van Hollen, the ranking member of the House Budget Committee, and other Democrats supporting him. And, of course, it's a radically different document and a different dynamic, different priorities than the budget resolution that the Republicans have advanced in the House. But my sense is that if we're willing to look beyond the bombast, there are places here for compromise and negotiation if either side or both sides is open to that. And we'll, of course, learn more about the Senate, I imagine, in the not-too-distant future.
That's true. We'll learn. Well, we will learn all we need to know about how the Senate is playing out the budget debate on Thursday, which is when they will have the word that you and I joked about last week, the vote-a-rama.
And I saw, by the way, that my original instinct was incorrect and that it's actually vote-a-rama.
Vote-a-rama.
Vote-o-rama.
Correct.
I went with O, and I think I'm the loser there.
Right. So under the, just to say it in a sentence, under the budget rules, you can't filibuster a budget, and you can't debate it endlessly. You can only debate a budget for 30 hours. But that 30 hours does not included in that 30 hours is the amount of time it takes for a senator to stand up and announce an amendment and get a roll call on it. So at the end of the 30 hours of debate, they can be expected to have 3, 4, maybe even 5 dozen votes on all manner of amendments from the Democrats, from the Republicans, on goofy stuff, on important stuff, on politically polarizing things, on petty things. And from that, and how many of those fall into which category, the serious versus the petty, will help us learn a little bit more about how serious this budget debate's going to be, and when it gets to conference, what's going to happen.
David Hawkins is senior editor at Roll Call and writing on his Hawkins Here blog today under the title, Why the GOP Will Likely Attack the Potemkin White House. There's a link to it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. The next step in this after the budget resolutions is what, David? Is it the conference? Are we that far along, or is there a lot more to it before that?
No, we are that far along. So this is the week that both the House and the Senate are going to adopt. The Republicans have the votes in both the House and the Senate to get their more similar than different, but somewhat different budget plans through the House and then through the Senate. Then there's a two-week recess bracketing Easter and Passover, and then they come back in the middle of April and see if they can negotiate a middle ground. There are reasons, in theory, the Republican and all Republican process should yield a deal, and that's an all Republican deal. But there are still some nettlesome differences, and if the really conservative factions in the Senate and the House dig in their heels, it might be a problem. Either way, what we do know is that what they do agree on, the House and the Senate, is the top line, pretty close to agree on the top line for spending, which means that the appropriations process should at least get off to a timely start, which is early May.
And how does that number compare to the Budget Control Act caps that would put us in sequester zone?
Unclear. The Senate budget resolution goes above the defense cap, leaves the non-defense cap the same, and in a wigglier way, the House one does too.
Well, the House respects the BCA number for the defense budget, but then adds, I want to say, 50 some billion to the overseas contingency operations budget. So it kind of does it and cheats at the same time.
It does it
the idea.
At the same time, right? So this is the OCO, OCO. We'll hear lots of "let go of my OCO" talk about right. The House budget would use this. Critics will call it a slush fund. Those who favor it, and even some of the defense hawks think this is a bad idea. They want the actual number for defense, the baseline number, to be increased, but the best that they can hope for is to get this one-year-at-a-time fund plumped up. So I think that's going to have to be negotiated, and that's going to be tough to negotiate, and the defense hawks are on both sides are a little peeved that this hasn't been an easier process. But the domestic number is not changing. The domestic number is going to hew to the caps, maybe with some discussion that if they get a elusive budget deal later in the summer that saves some money from entitlements or from closing tax loopholes, they can spend it on defense as well as non-defense. But for now, the assumption is they're sticking with the cap level on non-defense.
So the question here always is votes, and I don't expect you to have a whip count, obviously, yet, but do you have a sense that Speaker Boehner, either on the resolution vote or on the after-conference vote on budgets, is willing to give some ground to Nancy Pelosi and try to get some Democratic votes to go along with or counterbalance the right-wing Tea Party folks that he's probably going to lose?
No. In a word, because there is nothing that the Republican budget resolution on both sides, House and Senate, is so antithetical to what essentially all Democrats. I mean, remembering that the number of moderate centrists, you know, the old conservative Southern Democrat, that's more than an endangered species. Those people are extinct. So the two Democratic caucuses are pretty liberal, and you didn't even get Mark Warner or Tim Kaine to sniff at the budget when it was in committee. They're both on the Senate Budget Committee. No Democrat's going to vote for this thing, no matter what, because it is just too antithetical on too many other fronts: Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, cuts in entitlements, et cetera, et cetera. They're not going to touch it. So Boehner and McConnell are going to have to pass this thing with entirely Republican votes.